As I said last night, my task over the next few days is to lead you in discussion of the contribution that Aquinas makes to the question that we're looking at this week, the person and the polis. And really, the goal I've set for myself is just to convey to you this week that there is nothing more natural, you know, for Augustine than for the person to belong to the polis, or the person, the human creature, to be part of a political community. That idea itself is seminal for Aquinas because it does shape his entire discussion, especially in the Summa, on the question of justice. And I, just as way of introduction, just want to introduce something to you as an illustration of why, for Aquinas, there's nothing more natural than for the person to be part of a political community. This illustration is drawn principally from the Secunda Secundae, question 61. There, Aquinas talks about justice in general, but in particular, why and how it is that there are particular kinds of justice that we can look at and examine, what he calls species of justice. That if justice is the virtue by which we render the other his due, there are different kinds of others to whom the due is rendered. And because there are different kinds of others to whom the due is rendered, we can distinguish then between different kinds of justice. When Aquinas talks about the three kinds of parts of the three species of justice, what he's really doing is illustrating that the human creature, the human person, finds himself always within an intricate network of relations in which justice unfolds. So if we can talk about individual, the political community, the individual is part of the political community, this is what he has in mind when he's talking about the three kinds of justice. So first of all, if justice is rendering the other his due, what is it that we owe when the political community as a whole is the other to whom we owe justice? In other words, there is something that the individual owes to the political community in justice. And when that is the kind of justice that's exercised, Aquinas calls that general or legal justice. So the political community as a whole is the other to whom the individual renders what is due. What does the individual owe to the whole? The second species of justice emerges when you consider what it is that the political community owes to the individual. What the political community owes as a whole to one of its parts. And this is distributive justice. The other to whom the due is rendered is an individual, but the one giving, the one rendering the due, is not another individual, but in fact the entire political community, represented in most instances by the political authority. Then we can also see that a third kind of justice emerges when individuals render the due to other individuals. And this is commutative justice. That's not important that we remember all these names or the direction in which justice moves in these three instances, but rather to get a sense that for Aquinas, in discussing justice, seeing that it's complex in its three species, and why? Because the individual always and everywhere finds himself in a network of relationships to other individuals, to the political community, that he is always a part of some greater whole. And this identifies, this defines the human person as an agent of justice. For Aquinas, there is no mere individual. There's no historical moment in which the human individual finds himself outside of this natural network of relation. There's no moment in a person's life from conception to death when the individual doesn't find himself as a part of the political whole.
least potentially.
When you grasp this, the whole of the Treatise of Justice opens up, because when Aquinas speaks especially about commutative justice, he begins his discussion of individuals rendering other individuals the due by first identifying the individuals involved as part of the greater whole. And the fact that the individual is always a part of the greater whole, even when he's simply rendering what's just to another individual, the fact that they're both parts of the greater whole is definitive for Aquinas and shapes even their commutative, individual, private exchanges. It's this reality that, for Aquinas, justifies why it is that the political authority can arbitrate disputes between individuals. It's because of this natural network of relations that in disputes, individuals don't take justice in their own hands, but rather allow the political community to arbitrate for them. As we see, it's as part of the greater whole that the individual, even in exchanging with other individuals, receives his dignity, his identity, as part of the greater whole. So again, for Aquinas, there's nothing more natural than for the individual to belong to the political community, to the person to find himself in the polis, and the linchpin here that really kind of holds the whole network of relations together and really acts as the keystone for this structure is the political community, the good of the political community, the common good, which even suggested in the way that this graph takes shape, holds a certain primacy and priority in comparison with the goods of individuals, of parts. And that's what we're going to be looking at over the course of the next 4 days. How the person, for Aquinas, is related to the political community, and why it is that the good of the political community in the life of the individual takes a certain priority or prominence that shapes his whole life. So our purpose over the next 4 sessions in discussing Aquinas is simply to look at the general outline of St. Thomas Aquinas' doctrine of the common good. Our objective is to specify, first of all, the metaphysical quality that Aquinas observes the common good to enjoy as a natural phenomenon. In the realm of goods, for Aquinas, the common good holds a unique and noble place, and we'll examine why. Further, we'll also specify the love that Aquinas observes the common good to demand of the human creature as a good designed by God to perfect man's nature. If the common good is unique among the goods of the person, then the common good demands to be loved uniquely by the human person. And so in sum, we'll explore from Aquinas' point of view what the common good is and how it's to be loved. And that's what we'll look at over the next 4 sessions. What will emerge from these 2 explorations is an appreciation of the way that Aquinas situates his treatment of the common good within more general considerations. For Aquinas, the common good is not just a political question, and it's not a topic that arises simply in political discussions. For Aquinas, the common good is not only a political topic, but also an anthropological and even a cosmological one. Because as we'll see, for Aquinas, the political common good is only one instantiation of a metaphysical principle that pervades the entire cosmos, which are goods that are common, take a certain priority over goods that are particular. Goods that have many beneficiaries at once enjoy a certain nobility and primacy over those goods that have only one, or let's say a small number, smaller number of beneficiaries. Again, we'll look at the reason why. And so accordingly, Aquinas' political discussion of the common good draws on and employs these anthropological and cosmological considerations. And once we get clued into that, then, again, that's another reason why the Treatise of Justice just opens up. Because you can see how it is for Aquinas in the relation of human beings within the political community, the relation of human beings in justice one to another in the political community is just one reflection of the primacy of the common good that pervades the entire cosmos. And so this introduction, then, to Aquinas' doctrine of the common good will unfold in the next four talks. Today we'll talk about the goodness of the common good, what it is that makes the common good good. The common good is a good. What makes it good? Tomorrow we'll look at the commonness of the common good. What is it about the common good that makes it common? What does it mean for the common good to be common? On Wednesday, we'll look at the love of the common good. How for Aquinas it's to be loved properly as common. And then finally, on Thursday, we'll look at the lover of the common good, the human creature, as one oriented to the common good as his better good. Better compared to his particular good. So is that clear? Just the outline will follow. The goodness of the common good, the commonness of the common good, the love of the common good, and finally, the lover of the common good, and that's what we'll look at. Our guide for this discussion, as you saw from the readings I suggested for our time together, is Charles de Koninck. 1943, he wrote a little essay called The Primacy of the Common Good Against the Personalists. For many Thomist writers, this remains one of the better presentations of Aquinas' doctrine of the common good, not just for the 20th century, but really for the whole of the Thomistic history, Thomistic tradition. When you look back at all of the commentators that Aquinas has had, I mean, not many have focused on this particular question. They'll talk about the common good as they comment generally on Aquinas' doctrine of justice, but no one has really focused a particular work on Aquinas' doctrine of the common good, partly because Aquinas himself, when you go through the Summa and his other writings, he doesn't, like, there's no treatise on the common good, you know, on the Summa. So in order to really pick up the key elements of Aquinas' doctrine, you have to read the whole and tease out the salient parts. Not many commentators have done that. De Koninck did that in 1943 in a relatively short essay, but it remains among the best places, I think, to begin, at least if you want to grasp Aquinas' doctrine of the common good. De Koninck is a good place to begin. Scholars have generally agreed that this remains the best presentation of Aquinas' doctrine of the common good produced in recent years. And as Father Dominic said in the introduction, that I had the pleasure of writing my dissertation just on focusing on this essay itself. So before we begin to look then at De Koninck's essay, just a word of introduction about him. Who is Charles de Koninck? He was Belgian born, raised in Detroit. He returned to Belgium to study science. That was his, at least, first desire was to become a scientist. But his science professors soon learned, after having him in class, that his interests weren't in science itself, but rather philosophy. That the questions he asked, the things that really interested him about science, were not the facts of science themselves, but rather the philosophical implications of the findings of scientific research. And so they pushed him in the direction of philosophy. That, combined with reading philosophy with the Belgian Dominicans at the time, really convinced him that that was the way to go. And so he began to study philosophy, eventually earning a doctorate in philosophy from the University of Louvain through the Cardinal Mercier Center. He achieved that in 1934. In the beginning, in 1934, to his death in 1965, he taught philosophy at the University of Laval in Quebec City. As a philosopher, de Koninck's specialty was philosophy of science. And if you look at his corpus, that's what he tended to publish most on. This is the focus of his dissertation, which was on the philosophy of Sir Walter Eddington. Eddington was a British physicist, astrophysicist, who more than perhaps anyone else popularized the theories of Einstein for the English-speaking world. Because of this, Eddington became kind of a focus of attack by Thomist thinkers of the time, who were uncomfortable with such, let's say, kind of positive presentations of relativity and questions of indeterminism in nature and things like that, that made supposedly Aristotelian Thomist a little nervous. De Koninck actually came to Eddington's defense to show against the critiques of Thomist how questions of relativity, indeterminism, and things like that actually find a place within the Thomist, Aristotelian Thomist point of view, philosophy of science. And that's how de Koninck got his start. And over the course of his career, focused on questions of philosophy of science, and it was really only occasionally that he wrote on moral, political, and even theological topics. And it's really this essay that we're going to look at, The Primacy of the Common Good, is one of these occasional writings for de Koninck. De Koninck wrote Primacy out of a concern that in the years leading up to the Second World War and in the first years of that war, Catholic intellectuals were innocently but negligently adopting into their own thinking personalist understandings of human dignity and human love, ideas that were new and ascendant at the time. They were adopting these personalist understandings of human dignity and human love that, according to de Koninck, were at odds with the Catholic tradition. The new personalist ideas had much more in common, from de Koninck's point of view, with Marxism than Thomism, due in large part to the doctrine of the primacy of the person that they advocated, hence they were called the personalists. Key to the doctrine of the primacy of the person advocated by these writers, again from de Koninck's point of view, was an illicit instrumentalizing of the common good and subjecting it to the particular good in a way very similar to what Marx had envisioned in his own anthropological writings, which were a prelude to his later economic and political writings. De Koninck saw that this way of envisioning the primacy of the person didn't defend and promote the Catholic tradition, or at least the Thomist tradition, but rather enthroned the individualist self and his own particular happiness at the center of all concern. And to counter this proposal and to remind Catholic writers of the wider and greater tradition of the person and human dignity, de Koninck made the Thomist case for the primacy of the common good, hence the title of his essay. So for the next two sessions, we're going to look specifically and philosophically at the question of the good. What is it about the common good that makes it good? That's what we'll look at today. What is it about the common good that makes it common? We'll look at that tomorrow. But before we begin today by looking at the goodness of the common good, it might be important to take a moment just to study a bit what we might call de Koninck's, and by extension Aquinas's, objective look at the good. Because I think when we read this today, the good moderns that we are, it can be rather off-putting. Because it doesn't seem that, how would you put it, that in their discussion of the good, they're really not concerned about what people, you know, for whom the good is good. And that's right, actually. Bernard Schumacher is a philosopher who teaches at the University of Fribourg in Switzerland. He did studies here in Washington over the course of his formation. He's a good friend of the Dominicans there. We were talking at dinner one evening. He teaches high school. He teaches philosophy not only at the university but also in a local high school or two. It's part of the Swiss curriculum that they actually teach philosophy in high school. And so we were just asking him at dinner one night, what's the toughest part about teaching high schoolers, Swiss high schoolers, philosophy? And he said the most difficult thing is to teach them about the good. Because essentially, and not just speculatively, but practically, they do not believe that there exists outside of themselves a good that can determine choice. That they're all convinced, even by the time they're 15 and 16 years old, that what makes something good is their will. It becomes good once they choose it as a good for themselves. The things outside of themselves can't determine choice. He says that's the hardest thing. He says if you can convince a Swiss high schooler that the good exists outside of themselves, you'll have, you know, achieve something great. I think that's what Aquinas, by extension Deconic, are doing here, in essence. This isn't their ultimate concern, but the way they approach the good is with concern to discover what it is outside of the realm of human volition and choice that makes something to be good. This is one of the complaints that Deconic has, you know, against the personalist writers that he takes on as his opponents. He says that their view of the common good becomes distorted because they begin first with the question of human flourishing. And what is it that the individual needs to flourish? In their case, what is it that the individual needs to escape totalitarian oppression? The concern is not a bad one. But to begin there, and then to define as good whatever can be instrumentalized to human flourishing, what it is that serves the human individual in the pursuit of happiness, defining that as good, instead of beginning by looking at things in themselves and how it is that they're good. And recognizing that how a thing is to be good determines how we choose it as a good for us. This is Aquinas' concern. So Aquinas Deconic take a more objective as opposed to a subjective view of the good. They want to look at the good object itself, and this is kind of climb inside of it, look around at its metaphysical reality in mystery. Identify what it is that makes it really good and how it is that as good it sparks desire in us. It moves appetite. And not the other way around. Not because we have appetite and will all of a sudden we impose that on something that makes it good. It's the exact opposite for Aquinas and Deconic. It's the good in itself that sparks appetite and then becomes the object of will. And that means that the good, qua good, as good, exists apart from and outside of will. So that's why this approach might be a little off-putting, but it's important that we recognize what's happening. And so first, then, to describe how it is that the common good is good, to kind of gives just really a two or three sentence summation of the Aristotelian Thomistic doctrine of the good in general. He says that the good is what all desire, insofar as they desire their perfection. The good has the note of final cause. And as final cause, the good is the cause of causes as and is diffusive of itself. So we're going to look at each of these three just to see what Aquinas has in mind here and what really Deconic is presupposing when he just presents this very short summary of the classical doctrine of the good in general. So first, the good is what all desire inasmuch as they desire their own perfection. What Aquinas and the whole Aristotelian Thomistic tradition see here as that desire and will in the human creature fits within a whole metaphysical framework of being and the good. And the metaphysical principle here at work is that what Aquinas identifies in the Prima Pars of the Summa Theologiae, question 5, article 1, what he calls the convertibility of being and goodness. This is a very important question for Aquinas for understanding what it means for something to be good. The convertibility of being and goodness for Aquinas means simply this, that to be is the same as to be good. For a thing to be is the same thing for it to be good. Both terms, to be and to be good, point to the same reality, but according to two different aspects. To be points to its act of being, and to be good points to that same act of being, but carries with it the notion of desirability. That to be is to be something desirable, either by itself or by someone else, something else. And of course, we have to be a little careful here. Aquinas is quick to note that it's really only in God that being and goodness are perfectly convertible. Only in God is the convertibility of being and goodness complete and exhaustive. The divine act of being is divinely and exhaustively good. Simply to be is to be perfectly good. And this is how God is and how he is good. In creatures, it's a bit different, a little more complicated. We're all wonderfully complicated, you know, compared to God. In creatures, the convertibility of being and goodness is qualified. The creaturely act of being is only relatively good. It's not completely or simply good. Simply to be, for the creature, is to be in such a way that can be further perfected according to the potencies of the creature's nature. And we see this all the time.
It's good that the baby is,
but it's better when the baby grows up, you know, becomes, you know, a neurosurgeon. The goodness of the being of the baby admits of augmentation, change, betterment, improvement, perfection, further perfection. And this is in every creature. Simply to be is to be good in a qualified way that's open to further perfection. Therefore, to be good simply for the creature, to be good perfectly, the creature has to augment his being. For Aquinas, this is the metaphysical principle that lies at the heart of desire. This is the reality out of which desire is born. Desire arises in the creature as the appetitive response to the goods that promise to augment his being.
I mean, for that baby to become an adolescent, young adult, in order to achieve the end of being a neurosurgeon, has to want, and does want, many things, like an education. Education, you know, appears then as the object of desire that augments and perfects, you know, that child growing up to become the neurosurgeon. So this is the principle for Aquinas, the metaphysical principle, you know, out of which love, you know, emerges, desire. For the goods that perfect. Because no creature is self-sufficient in terms of his own goodness. He's not self-sufficient in terms of providing for his own simple perfection. It's good that he is, but it's better for him to be made perfect. And the goods that lend and contribute to his perfection are the objects of desire, the objects of love. I summarized this just on page 128. I don't know if you've got the text in front of you, but I'll just read it briefly. It's just a quick summary of this point. Though simple in being, created things are not simply good. They remain in potency in regard to their simple and perfect goodness, which is not inherited from, but rather added to, their simple act of existence. Now, whatever is in potency naturally strives to actualize its potency. Hence, all creatures, in potency to their simple and perfect goodness, desire and strive for the ends and operations that provide this added perfection. So in striving for their simple and perfect goodness, created things desire the goods that perfect them, the goods that augment their being, that actualize their potency for perfection. So the good is what all desire insofar as they desire their perfection. It's important to identify that
metaphysical principle here of that, the convertibility of being in goodness, which in the creature is not an exact one-to-one correspondence as it is in God. But admits of increase, augmentation, perfection. Secondly, the good has a note of final cause. As an object that elicits desire and appetite, and as the end to which the subject with appetite moves, the causality that the good exercises on the subject is final causality. The good causes, Aquinas says, in the way that an end elicits desire. So important here is just to review what Aristotle had to say about the four causes. And you know what the four causes are: the material, the efficient, the formal, and the final cause. The good does something that's obvious. The good stirs appetite. The good actually does many things. The ancients recognize this, Aquinas recognizes this. But when specifying what kind of causality the good as good exercises, Aquinas, and I show this in the dissertation, goes to great lengths to specify that whereas the good, in some ways, we can consider exercise as a kind of efficient causality, there are ways in which the good also exercises a kind of formal causality. The good qua good, which specific to the causality of the good itself, is final causality. But the good is an end, and it causes as an end. That's what's proper to the good. To say that something is good is to say that it is an end, an object of desire, that for which something acts or toward which something acts
And that's the causality that it exercises.
And so although we can speak of the good as exercising formal and efficient causality, the good, properly speaking, is a final cause. And Aquinas correctly, gently corrects the classical tradition on this point. That for which a thing comes to be and in the pursuit of which it actualizes its potency is the good. This is how the good exercises its self-diffusion, which is the next point we'll get to. The good acts not primarily by making, through efficiency, nor by modeling. Formal causality, although the good can do both of these things, but by stirring appetite and causing desire. And finally, the good is the first of causes and diffusive of itself. There are two points of interest that highlight the primacy of goodness in the realm of cause. First, De Koninck notes that, and he's drawing on Aquinas here, the other three causes all work for an end. Agents work for a goal and exercising efficient causality. Matter is moved to form. This is at the heart of material causality. Form is inclined to imitate its cause. This is inherent to formal causality. Thus, that makes the end, that for which the other causes work, the good, the cause of causes, the first of causes, primary among the causes for Aquinas, is final cause. Secondly, as a cause, the good extends itself to more things than being. This is a fascinating point.
Aquinas is continuing with the objection that, well, since intellect is that which is first, being is that which first falls into the intellect, well, then efficient causality, that which brings being into being, must be what is primary among the causes. And Aquinas says no. And for this reason,
because the good as a cause extends itself to more things than being. Which is to say, good, final causality, extends itself to more things than efficient causality. Goodness can extend to what remains simply impotency to act.
In other words, goodness as a final cause can extend to things that don't yet exist. Whereas efficiency in being only extend to those things that actually exist.
Just think of the newly married couple
whose love for each other is very much rooted in a common love that they have for the firstborn that they're expecting, that they expect and hope to one day bring into the world.
That potential child is a good for them, even if it doesn't yet exist. So based on a simple kind of observation like that, Aquinas recognizes the primacy of the good, the primacy of final ends, that goodness can make desirable things that don't even yet exist. In this way, goodness, final causality, has a certain primacy over being and efficient causality. And this is the reason why final cause is the first of causes and the cause of causes. And finally, the good is diffusive of itself. It's here that Aquinas untangles the good's efficiency from its finality. Again, this is a problem that he contends with in the whole of his treatment of the good as final cause, contending with
classical writers who see kind of the importance of the good in the way it kind of makes other things good. Aquinas says, yes, that's true. But that the way that the good is self-diffusive is not by making other things good as an efficient cause, pushing subjects to move or act. Rather, the good is self-diffusive, again, as an end. It draws the subject to itself through engaging the subject's appetite. Thus, the good diffuses itself not by pushing, but by pulling. By standing as that for which something moves or acts without itself acting or moving. That's the good. And that's how it exercises final causality. That's how it diffuses itself and diffuses its goodness to others. Not by making others good, but drawing others into its goodness by sparking desire in appetite. So the good is that which all things desire. It has the note of final end. It's the first of causes and diffusive of itself. Each point for Aquinas, each point for Taconic, is important for understanding the objective nature of every good. We've not even begun to discuss specific goods yet and how they're good for individuals. It's just, again, an objective look at what makes something to be good. What are the qualities that it has as something good? It's desirable. It exercises final causality. And it's diffusive of itself as an end. It's this last point, the self-diffusiveness of the good as an end, that will stand out in our discussion tomorrow. Because it's precisely on the nature of the good self-diffusion that we can distinguish, for Aquinas, for Taconic, between the common good and the particular good. Based on the extent of a good's self-diffusion. Does it extend to one beneficiary only? Or does it extend to many beneficiaries at once? It's the key, the foundation to distinguishing between common and particular goods. And we'll have much more on that tomorrow. So just in terms of looking at the good objectively, then, it's important when we talk about the common good and to see the implications of the nobility of the common good, why this is important for Taconic. Again, it's important to have this objective view. That the good exists as good outside of us. Its goodness is a quality that the good enjoys as prerequisite to choice and will in us. And as we'll see Wednesday and Thursday, an implication here for both Aquinas and Taconic is that human perfection, human maturation, especially maturation in the moral life, which for Aquinas has some reflection in the maturation of our emotional life, that the mature person is the one who within himself and within his appetite mirrors the objective quality of the good outside of himself. The way that goods are arranged hierarchically according to their own goodness, according to their own nobility. In other words, will isn't what arranges goods for us according to our own design. Rather, the mature person is the one who recognizes that the good outside of himself is arranged in a hierarchical pattern. And the degree to which that pattern is mirrored in his own appetite, that he loves those goods according to their metaphysical ordering, is a sign of his maturation and perfection.
And that's why it is that for Taconic, loving the common good properly according to its proper nobility is something higher than the particular good, is a sign of human maturity and human perfection. But we'll get to that once either. That's kind of a prelude to what we'll discuss.
That was very fast, I know, and a little
technical. There, a lot is packed in there, but we were only given 60 minutes this morning to look at the goodness of the common good. It'll be important for us tomorrow. We'll have a little more time, and the discussion will be a little lighter, just in terms of looking at the commonness of the common good. But to make these objective points about the good is important to do today, make much more sense of the discussions we'll have for the rest of the week. We do have a couple of minutes, though, for questions. We're going to 11:15, so happy to.
Maybe this is quickly jumping into secondary subjects, but would it be safe to say that then, like, the presence of desire then informs the subject of its imperfection? Perhaps even more particularly, that where there exists desires, it implies where there exists imperfection.
Mm-hmm.
So, even for example, then, the desire to have a kid signals that the kid is instrumental towards the perfection of responsiveness.
That's a good question, because it can look that way from our point of view. But as we'll look at Wednesday, Aquinas has a way of understanding that various goods become proper to us and perfective of us according to various formalities, which is to say, according to the different relations that we can have to others. So there are certain ways in which, again, this is a preview, there are certain ways in which certain goods are good for us simply qua individuals. So like those things that keep us and sustain us in being, they're good for us individually. But there are also a whole range of goods that are good for us as members of a species that make no sense to us as being good for us apart from our being members of a species. So whereas nutrition, you know, is a good, the goods of nutrition belong to us, you know, qua mere individuals. The good of generation, you know, becomes good for us qua member of a species. And so it's not just a personal imperfection, you know, that the child supplies, but rather, one might say, the imperfection of the species insofar as it can be augmented by new members, and in fact flourishes when new members are added to it. So for Aquinas, that's something marvelous about appetite in the intellectual creature, is that its desire extends to goods that lie beyond its simple self-preservation. That the intellectual creature can actually act intentionally for the good of his entire species. And actually, there are two levels of good even above that. But that's helpful to see how the child there isn't instrumentalized simply. You know, it's not that we treat the child as a good for my own self-survival, but it actually, the child represents a good that's greater than my own immediate need for survival, but actually becomes a good for me insofar as I'm a member of a species, and I contribute to the flourishing of the species through the act of generation.
I think it's important to nuance his understanding of personalists.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, even as
right.
a wide range of personalists will admit, the name personalism refers
right.
to very diverse movements.
Right.
But for instance, you know, taking figures like Edith Stein, Carol Wojtyła, Joseph Ratzinger
mm-hmm.
as personalists in the sense of, you know, very much explaining the richness of the person
mm-hmm.
As part of the fabric of a robust moral theology. I think it's important to nuance the fact that personalism and the richness of the metaphysical tradition, I think, can be synthesized,
mm-hmm. right.
Which I think de Kooning kind of does himself a disservice in not being open to in his polemic.
I wouldn't say that. I think he's quite... May I treat this in the like the first part of the dissertation, which is, you know, anytime the Deaconic comes up or is brought up, I mean, these questions naturally arise. In that Deaconic is a victim of his own kind of writing because he doesn't identify the specific personalist he has in mind. But if you do a close read of his criticism, then the work is ours to figure out, you know, and I think he intended it to be that also. He has certain statements in there that he's not. If the concern is totalitarian oppression and how to, you know, defeat that and preserve and promote personal dignity, you know, in the face of totalitarian oppression, yes, appeal to human dignity is the way to go, and the dignity of the person. He agrees with that. What he disagrees with is the way in which some personalist writers were promoting the kind of idea of the kind of primacy of the person that negates the tradition. And he gives you indications as to what he means by that, what he's concerned about. So there were certain personalist writers in his day. This was their move in fighting against totalitarianism. Looking at the human creature, they would make a distinction between the material person and the spiritual individual. I'm sorry, the material individual and the spiritual person. And they say, sure.
Yes, this all makes sense when we look at the human creature insofar as he's a material individual.
He's part of the cosmos, part of the family, part of the city, and those goods can make certain demands on him. But insofar as the human creature is a spiritual person, he transcends all of this. That he's only subject really to God and to nothing else. So that's the move they made to kind of bring the person out from under kind of the heel of totalitarian states and say, well, in the fullness of what man is, he's not subject to any, let's say, community, save the communion that he can enjoy with God. And that's what Deaconic takes objection to. And that's why he defends this. In fact, it's according to the whole that the human creature is, that he's part of greater wholes, and that doesn't, you know, sacrifice anything of his dignity. In fact, it's just the opposite. That man augments his dignity when he chooses and loves the common good as the better good for himself, because it's a good not just for him individually, but a good for him insofar as it's also a good for others. So it puts him into intimate communion with others. And so he faults the persons for actually adopting the same kind of ideas that common good as the totalitarians have as something instrumental to be used either to oppress the individual. The persons just turn that around and make the state or the political community just an instrumental good to my own individual flourishing. So they just kind of reverse the formula without correcting the totalitarians according to the classical notion of the common good. So that's Deaconic's project. And that's why he's, you know, careful to identify that the kind of personalism that he's attacking is really just 19th century individualism kind of wrapped in the flag of the person. And that's what that's the kind of personalism he attacks. Doing further work, someone like Kerouac
stands as a good counterexample, as someone who escapes Deaconic's criticism,
because there you do have a philosopher taking the early to mid 20th century kind of subjective concerns, but trying to answer them, you know, with a fuller objective understanding of the metaphysical reality that the person finds himself in, the metaphysics of thick metaphysics of the good. And that seems to me what Thiebaud's project was. I don't know if he ever read Deaconic. For that reason, I don't even know if he ever read Mounier in Maritime, because he actually stands, you know, really apart from them in terms of how he understands the dignity of the human person to operate.
Let's give our thanks to Claudia.